Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hi, guys. This is Toby Mathis from Anderson Business Advisors, and you're listening to Tax Tuesday. I'm joined today by Jeff Webb. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how's it going, Toby?
It's going fantastic, and you're in the right spot if you want to hear some stuff about taxes. Let's just jump right on in. I know that we have a tendency to go over. We try to do these in an hour, but we've never actually, I think, managed to get it underneath the hour. Maybe once. Let me see. Make sure I can get it. If you guys have questions, by the way, just make sure that you're asking in the question pane. I already see a whole bunch. Boy, these guys are active today, Jeff.
Yeah,
holy schmoly. What's up with you guys? Somebody teach everybody how to type. Anyway, we're going to go through some of our little background rules. First off, if you can, join us on social media. We do disseminate a lot of information that way. You can go to YouTube and listen to our videos. If you click on that little, it looks like a little key or a bell or something. It's a notification icon. What will happen is you'll be notified when new videos come up, only when you sign in. So you don't have to worry about getting hit up constantly with emails or things like that. That's not how it works. You just go on in there. And if we do have notices, we tend to do them in webinars. We tend to do them in video. Just, for example, in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, people are just figuring out some of the things now. If you had been on our YouTube channel, you would have actually had videos in January, the month after it passed, January of 2018. You would have known about these things a long time ahead of time. The reason being this is important is because a lot of folks only realize that they've lost something when they actually have to pay the extra tax. So we try to avoid that. Tax Tuesday rules, you could ask live and we'll answer before the end of the webinar. We try to do this. If you ask some goofy, long questions, don't write me a book. It needs to be a pretty succinct little question. But if it is a short question, then sometimes I ask you questions too. You'll see that when Jeff and I are going through these, sometimes we're asking clarifying questions, trying to drag this thing over here, because we want to make sure that we're getting you the best detailed response. But if you write us too long, we're not going to be able to answer it. If you write it short and sweet, we will get to it. Here's an interesting one. So I'm going to give you guys an example right out the gate, because if somebody wrote a pretty interesting question. So before I get there, if you have long questions, send them to TaxTuesday@AndersonAdvisors.com. If you need a very specific detailed response, you're going to need to become a platinum client or a tax client of ours. It's actually really cheap. Being a platinum client is $35 a month. Being a tax client is, I think it's $29.95, and it's basically essentially a retainer, but you get a lot of bells and whistles, including access to our tax classes and a very comprehensive tax consultation and things like that. The whole idea of this Tax Tuesday is it's fun, fast, and educational. We want to get back and help educate. All right, now let's go to this question. How to take full advantage of excess depreciation on passive real estate investments. This is interesting. So somebody says they have $1 million in passive multifamily equity shares and partnerships. So they have a bunch of equity in a partnership. Let's see, regular bonus plus cost seg. You're hitting it right in the head. You have $1 million in passive multifamily. If you cost seg it, and you, what that means is you're breaking out the components and you're writing off quicker than the 27 and a half year. So if it's multifamily, it's residential property. And if it's 27 and a half years, which is what's called modified accelerated cost recovery systems, mm-hmm. You can accelerate a bunch of those into 5, 7, and 15-year property and write them all off in year one under those scenarios, under the new bonus depreciation under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. The problem is, and they said this, is that if you're not a real estate professional, you cannot offset your W-2 employer income. So the real estate professional needs to be one spouse. And so if you're married, you would have to make sure somebody is the real estate professional. And the test that you're using, so this is actually a guy named Walt, the test that you're using, there's two pieces to it. Piece number one is 750 hours plus more than 50%. One spouse needs to qualify for that. So it doesn't, if you're a W-2 employee and you're working 2,000 hours a year, you are not going to qualify as a real estate professional, unless you're in a real estate trader business. And that means, you know, basically you mentioned a few, but I don't even think a mortgage broker is going to work. You need to be a real estate agent. You need to be in the process or broker, construction person, asset, you know, real estate manager. Those types of things will qualify. And then piece number two is that you materially participate on your real estate. And what we do here is we make an election to aggregate all your real estate activities. This is the one. Jeff, how often do you see people miss this?
Quite a bit, especially in cases where it's obvious they're taking large losses and they're not able to deduct them. Mm-hmm. And they have a spouse who is not working, yeah. Which is the perfect opportunity for this.
Yep. And so when you hit it, so, well, you're right on. I'm just going to tell you that first off. You're right on. Great job. You get to write off that passive income. And it's no longer passive under 460. What is it?
469.
Yeah, C7. It's an exception. And what it becomes is non-passive, i.e. offsetting your active income. So it'll offset your W-2. So the best example I can give you is an actual client, a lawyer friend of mine down in Savannah, Georgia, who makes millions of dollars a year settling big traumatic head injury cases. And his wife is a real estate professional. And they buy lots and lots of real estate. And he takes the depreciation against his active ordinary income. In many years, he pays zero in tax. Now, that sounds great. But if you're trying to get a loan, it's a little tough. So if you're trying to buy a house and you have zero income, it's a little frustrating. But yes, you'd be able to do it. Somebody else says, what if the partner is a retirement plan? Yeah, the retirement plan is not going to be a material participant. In fact, it can't be. Does it have to file a 990T? What is he looking at? Not the 5500. It's a retirement plan. An IRA is never going to file that. He's looking at the UBIT. If it's debt-related income, then technically you could have UBIT on it. So if you are, this is what's weird. So you have an IRA and it invests in a syndication. Mm-hmm. And that syndication leverages the asset. So let's say you put $2 million in and they use debt of $5 million to buy a piece of property. And then you start getting the income in. Well, you actually have a majority of it being UBIT, technically.
Right.
How many people actually file the UBIT on that, do you think?
Very few, because I know a few years back we were seeing a lot of people were putting oil and gas partnerships into their...
That's active.
And that's active income. And says right on the K-1s that they received that it's UBIT, and they weren't reported. Fortunately, those entities were usually taking losses on the K-1. So No harm, no foul.
This is when you get a CV. You're supposed to pay the UBIT, but most people don't. And the IRS really doesn't sit there and check into all these things. Another one somebody asks is, I have an LLC for my rental properties. I take distributions out when I need it. That's fine. I was pinning one of those houses and broke my heel. Can the LLC pay for things such as copayment for therapy, et cetera? That's interesting. I've never really thought about it if you injure yourself. I would actually be looking at your insurance. And if you have no insurance, you can't really sue yourself.
No, I don't even think your own insurance is going to cover this. A workman's comp policy would, but yeah. Most people don't do workman's comp for themselves.
No, usually they're exempt. Yeah. So the answer to your question is, if you broke your heel, you're still able to take those expenses and you can get reimbursement from a C Corp employer or an employer that has a cafeteria plan if it's not you. If it is you, you just got to make sure you have a C Corp and it can reimburse 100% of the costs. The way that you'd get the money into the C Corp is you'd make sure it's managing the LLC that has the rental property or the property in which you got hurt. That's way number one. Way number two is you exceed the 10% of your adjusted gross income this year, unless it was last year, in which case it's 7.5%. But this year it would be a Schedule A expense on your schedule or on your 1040. So those are the two ways. The other thing you could do, I guess you could do a self-funded health plan, HSA? HSA.
You could do an HSA. Yeah.
Yeah, you do the HSA and pay for the expenses out of that. But I think would you have to have the HSA ahead of time?
You're going to have an HSA and you're going to have that high deductible health plan too.
So. Yeah. So I just love giving really weird answers. So Salvador, the answer to your question is you're not going to be able to write it out as a business expense. I don't believe. Off the top of my head, I just don't think so. It's going to be a health expense, and even though you did it working on a piece of property, realistically, you're going to have something else that has a health reimbursement arrangement or a health savings account, or you're writing it off on your Schedule A of your 1040. Or if you have another employer and they have a health reimbursement plan, then you make sure that you're making a claim there. Can you discuss the importance of resolutions for an entity, say minutes? Hey, Gary, we have a ton of them on our website. If you become platinum, we do it for you. Or excuse me, maybe that's not right. If you have the office suite, we do it. If it's platinum, you have access to all of them, and I think you do it. Most of our clients, we do the minutes resolution. So I would just reach out and maybe Susan or Patty can give Gary the information or grab his information so somebody can talk to him. Let's go through and let's retain some of these questions because we haven't even said what all the questions we're going to be going over today. We got a ton. You guys are so active today. Jiminy Christmas. All right. So here's the questions we're going to go over. I converted $250,000 of my traditional IRA to a Roth in early 2019. What options do I have to mitigate the tax consequences? We'll go over that one. When a spouse dies and the surviving spouse is a step-up in basis, is the surviving spouse required to sell the community home within 12 months of the spouse's death in order to enjoy the step-up in basis? Does the step-up in basis expire at some point? What is the best way to set up an Airbnb business that is solely owned single-family house? We'll answer that. What is the process to turn a rental into a personal residence? Is it considered a sale when it becomes a personal residence? How is the cost determined when it becomes a personal residence? We'll answer that. How do I separate the cost of a washer, dryer, refrigerator, kitchen cabinets, AC system, wooden floors, etc., from a recently purchased condo? Purchase contract shows total price only. And this is my favorite. Parents own a home with two extra rooms for their two kids. If the kids share a room and rent out the spare room, what are the tax consequences? Love that. For an equity investor, what is the best way to structure ownership when concerning taxes? LLC, personal, can the LLC be from the home state of the investment property? If I sell my, well, I answer that too. If I sell my personal residence, what would be the best strategy to use the funds from the sale for my RAL setup? I do have a QRP, it's 401k for those of you guys who don't know. So can I use those retirement funds for the upgrades and repay the loan from the proceeds? We'll answer that too. Can I get reimbursed by my S Corp for the use of my personal pickup truck for the last three quarters of the year? The truck is financed in my name and I was making the payments myself, but using the truck for business. We'll go over that one as well. I told you we had a few. So Jeff, you can see Jeff literally slumping down in his chair. He's like going underneath the table because I kind of pick all the questions that we're going to answer and I forget to stop. All right. I traveled via RV cross country. It sounds like fun. Even out of the country. So you must have gone out of the country. It's Canada or Mexico, right? Unless you can drive across water. And needed Wi-Fi to conduct business. Can any part of the travel expense be deducted?
That's interesting.
Yeah. I actually had three RV questions. We narrowed it down to two. I don't know what it is about RVs. I think it's the end of the season. But they're different people. Can I rent my RV to a corporation for meetings? How is it taxed? Last one is I sold one of my rental homes this year. If I have a gain of $200,000 and invest in a syndication buying an apartment complex, and if they use bonus depreciation, will it offset any part of my gain? So we'll go over that. We got a lot of really good questions. I love that. And by the way, you guys have not let up. It's literally nonstop questions from you guys today. What's up? So this is like the kid in the backseat going, why? Not that I did that this weekend, but I did that this weekend. So anyway, so we got a whole bunch of good questions. I will be getting on to all your guys's, can you change this slide? Mina, you're not much fun. We will go through all of these and it's lots of fun. All right, so here's the first one. I converted $250,000 of my traditional IRA to a Roth in early 2019. What options do I have to mitigate the tax consequences? What say you, Jeff?
Well, I would have had different advice a year ago and even more different advice 5 years ago. 5 years ago, you could actually split the gain between a couple of years and pay the taxes on it. Last year, you could actually recharacterize this Roth conversion back to an IRA and maybe hit. I probably would have suggested if it's an issue, then we only convert so much during the year. Unfortunately, as of 2018, there is no such thing as a recharacterization from a Roth conversion. So as soon as you convert it, you have $250,000 of income. There's no way to mitigate that income in itself. So you have to kind of look at what other things that you would normally do to reduce income.
When they converted it, it was a big taxable event. It's taxable in 2019. So what you have is there's really only a few ways you're going to offset traditional IRA income going into the Roth. And that's to come up with traditional expenses that are actually offset your income. And we can count on pretty much one hand at what you're going to get. You're going to look at your Schedule A, which means if you have a lot of medical expenses, this is the year to pay them. You want to make sure that you're paying interest on your home if you have it. You want to make sure that whatever your expenses are to your state for income taxes or real estate taxes, you're capturing those. And this is the year where you may want to say, you know what, I'm going to give a whole bunch to charity.
Yep.
And just because I want to offset a bunch of my income. If you say, Toby, you're nutty, buddy. I don't want to give a whole bunch of money to charity. Maybe you just look and say whether you're a tither. Give 3 or 4 or 5, 6, 7 years, whatever it is, in advance. Give it to a DAFI or set up your own 501c3. And a DAFI is a donor advised fund where you get the deduction in the year that you make the contribution, but then you dole it out over many years. This is a big one for me. So the other one is you could do a conservation easement, maybe where you you do something along those lines. In a conservation easement, the conservative ones are going to give you a 4-to-1 to 5-to-1 return. In other words, if I give them a dollar, I might get a $4 deduction. So if you have $250,000, obviously to offset that entire amount, you'd have to give a sizable amount of money, about $75,000, maybe closer to $60,000, depending on the fund. But then you won't pay the tax on it. And the tax, depending on what state you're in and what level, could be much higher. So you just have to kind of do that. The other one is real estate professional. If you are a real estate professional, that could be either you or your spouse, they qualify, then you can do something called a cost segregation and bonus depreciation to take most of the depreciation in the first year. And when I say most, it's really about 30% of it. So if you have a, you know, $300,000 improvement on a property, a $400,000 property, but $300,000 of improvement, you're probably going to get about $100,000 deduction. So those are the things that you do. The last one is you're already doing a traditional IRA into a Roth. You may want to look at your other options to do retirement plans and to try to offset some of that conversion by putting more money into a traditional.
Yeah, this is really a case. We can do nothing about the $250,000 itself. But if we look at your entire, or you look at your entire tax plan, you can decrease the amount of income you have.
And that's what you're trying to do. You're just trying to see whether there's a way to mitigate it. So I hope that makes sense. Let's see. Next one. When a spouse dies and the surviving spouse is a step up in basis, is the surviving spouse required to sell the community home within 12 months of their spouse's death in order to enjoy the step up in basis? Does the step up in basis expire at some point?
No and no. There is no expiration on the step up in basis. You never have to sell that property if that's what you want to do.
This gets so much fun, by the way. When you have a step up, if, for those of you guys who don't know what the step up is, let's say I buy a house at $100,000 and 30 years later, it's worth $1 million. Before you think I'm crazy, that happens all the time. In a community property state, when one spouse passes, the tax basis of that property moves up to $1 million. The value on the date of passing, or I believe you can do the date of the estate tax return. So it'll be within 9 months. The hard part is figuring out what that is. That's the rough one, is how do I value it? And so the best thing to do is go out and get an appraisal, and that locks in your time. And then that way you always know. If you're in a separate property state, then one half of the basis of the house steps up. So it even gets weirder. So you have, you know, a husband and wife, let's just say. One spouse passes. 5 years later, the second spouse passes. So you have a step up from 5 years ago in one half of the property. And you're like, I don't know why these states do it that way, but it can get a little weird. So the rule of thumb is when somebody passes, probably go out and get an appraisal of the property so you can lock it in.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't expire. And what this means is that if you sell the house, so let's say husband and wife, California, community property state, one passes, the basis steps up to the fair market value of the house. And if the surviving spouse sells it, you don't have to sell it within 12 months. There's no rules there. And your basis is a step up. It's forever. So that's the date etched in stone. Boom. Now we have a step up. If you sell it pretty close to the date of passing, you're not really going to have to worry about any gain. If it's your home, you have a huge exclusion. So you may want to sit on it for a while. But what I see as an attorney that sits in the tax world is I'll see people gifting things with really low basis. And you're looking at them going, hey, dude, wait, all you got to do is die and it steps up. You're avoiding the tax benefit because they think they need to get out of their estate. Somebody asked a really good question, by the way. Can you do a cost seg on a property that you already own and maybe get an offset? Absolutely, John. In fact, we're still going back into 2018. This sounds really twisted, but if you have an extension, we can still make a change of accounting and do that. Here's another good one. All right. Which one protects the properties better, to have the property in a trust or an LLC? Well, you kind of do both. You never just do a trust. Sometimes you do just an LLC, but you never just do a trust without an LLC.
No, we're talking personal residence or other property.
Which one protects the property? I'm talking about anything that's an investment property. Usually I don't like to take houses and stick them in any LLCs. You got homesteads, and then you also have ways to draw the equity out. And you can usually, you know, burn down your house before somebody takes it. I've seen a house taken one time, and that was a gal who's just egregiously given advice by the attorneys, and she had a whole team, and she ended up losing 15 properties, and they took her house away, and nobody really gave her the option of filing a bankruptcy and stopping it, or any number of things that could have happened, and they didn't use LLCs, and there's like a bunch of nonsense, but the gal lost, you know, it's just bad. So it was not good. But yeah, but usually the trust is just something we use for title. The classic example of a land trust is the Illinois style, which came out of the Sears Tower in Chicago. And they were acquiring the land in various trust names so people didn't know they were community of the land. And all it is it's an agreement to hold title with the beneficiary being separate from the legal owner. So I could put anybody I want on the title. Technically, I could be your trustee, but the beneficial owner is somebody else, and it's usually we assign it to an LLC, so you get the asset protection. The trust itself doesn't give you any asset protection, although there's some practitioners that will pretend like it does. It doesn't. If you get sued, they're going after the beneficial ownership, so you want to make sure that's taken away. Let's see. We have a C-Corp with health benefits for my wife as an employee. Can I have the C-Corp reimburse my wife and include the expense paid for by the HSA? Include expenses paid for. You can't double dip.
Yeah, you can't reimburse anything that's already been paid by an HSA.
Mm-hmm. And Christina, I answer the questions that come in, so I apologize for not moving the slide. I always get people saying, move the slide. I'll move the slide. All right. Let's see. When I become 65, can I use the HSA to pay premium for supplemental health insurance? Yeah, can't he? Can you use the HSA to pay for other stuff?
Yeah, but the HSA can't pay for health insurance premiums.
It just can't pay the health insurance premiums.
It can only pay out of pocket.
All right. Expenses. So I hope that helps. All right. On to the question that's actually sitting in front of us. What is the best way to set up an Airbnb business that is solely owned single family house? That is a wholly owned single family house. And so this is where it gets really interesting. When you have an Airbnb business, and if the average day that a guest stays in your house is 7 days or less, then it's really a hotel. And it becomes a different type of taxation. It's subject to self-employment tax when it's over 7 days on average. And you just take the total number of days it was rented by the total number of guests, and that's going to get your number. Then it's passive. And either way, you're going to take your depreciation. But if it's a solely owned single family house and you don't live there, then generally speaking, here's what I'm going to do. If I know that I'm going to average, let's say, 3 days for rental, then I am going to set up an LLC for the real estate. That real estate is going to lease it under a monthly lease to my corporation or LLC tax as a corporation. And that corporation is going to be the host and is going to lease that property to the guest. That's kind of the general way of how you do the Airbnb business. You never want to have that one just sitting and hitting you on your personal return. So, yeah, some of you guys are worried about Jeff. He's had a cold, and poor Jeff. I see that. All right, let's keep going. All right, what is the process to turn a rental into a personal residence? You just have to rent it less than, 14 days and 10% of the time, you have to occupy it more than 10% of the time. If it's your personal residence, then it automatically becomes personal residence. Is it considered a sale when it becomes personal residence? No. And how is cost determined when it becomes a personal residence? The same as what you paid for it. So whenever you look at real estate, this is really fun. And hey, Tim, we'll get you with Eric real quick. He got blasted. I did a webinar and just smoked him. So he's getting to people. I'll make sure if anybody out there is reaching out for Eric from that webinar we did, just let me know. Just send it in and just say, hey, I'm waiting for Eric. But I think he had about 100 reports to do, so we'll make sure that gets done. All right, what is the process to turn a rental into a personal residence? It's easy. It's what you use it for, and it is not considered a sale. It is not considered a sale. You do not have step-up in basis. Here's what's interesting. Sometimes we do it the other way around, where you have a personal residence, and we want to capture the capital gains exclusion. If you don't know what that is, that's 26 U.S.C. 121. So it's called a 121 exclusion, where a single person who's lived in their home two out of the last 5 years, or a married couple two out of the last 5 years, single gets $250,000 of capital gains exclusion. Notice I said capital gains and not depreciation recaptures, just capital gains. And a married couple gets $500,000. So oftentimes you'll have a personal residence and you'll sell it to an S corp to make it into a rental. That's the only time you're ever going to hear me say corporation and rental, because we don't do it otherwise. But when you go the other direction, the part you have to be aware of is that little 121 exclusion is now damaged. Because if you had a rental and you made it into a personal residence, that period of time before it became a personal residence is non-qualified use. So when you start capturing your two out of the last 5 years, you're going to take it as a proportionate amount of how much capital gains you can exclude. So things to just consider, but your basis doesn't change. So when I have a personal, Jeff is back. So we're talking about the one where they converted the rental into a personal residence. And I'm just saying it's the basis doesn't change and you don't have to do anything special. They just have to make it into a personal residence. And if you had a period of time, let's say you did this in the middle of the year and half of it was personal residence and half of it was rental, you would write off depreciation for half of the year. You don't have depreciation on your personal residence. So it's proportionality. And you don't have to worry about the cost because they're using the same cost as whatever you bought it. It's the basis and the improvement values do not change until you have a sale or a step up in basis.
Right.
So really exciting stuff. All right. On the Airbnb, hold on for a second. What did you have?
I didn't have anything. Go ahead.
All right. So, Dan, are you guys okay? Don't cough up a spleen. Poor Jeff. All right. Is depreciation recapture completely negative for holding rentals, or is there a positive to it other than a 1031 exchange? So Blakely, whenever you have depreciation recapture and it's on straight line depreciation, it's maxed out at your personal tax bracket with a cap of 25%. So this is where it gets kind of fun. If you have a year where you have like some major low income and you have some losses you can take, you can actually keep your personal tax bracket low and you're going to get taxed very low on depreciation recapture. If it's more, like if you're in a really high tax bracket, then it's capped at 25%. That's a good thing. Just remember, it's always going to be more than long-term capital gains. And you can 1031 the whole thing. Like, so you can absolutely pencil the numbers to see whether a 1031 exchange makes sense to roll and avoid depreciation recapture. Now, there is one type of depreciation recapture that I want to cover with you guys, and that is when you do a cost seg. It's either going to be ordinary income or nothing. It's either going to be ordinary income or it's going to be taxed as long-term capital gains. And that's because when you depreciate a carpet, for example, five-year property is carpet, and I write it all off, and I've owned it for more than 5 years, it has no value. I'm not going to recapture any of it.
Right.
There's no value to that carpet. I'm going to throw it away. So it's going to be capital gain. Anyway, that's really exciting. Somebody says, on the Airbnb rent to my corp, can I do the monthly rent as a percentage of income? I don't think so. I think it has to be a fixed amount for it to be considered. But Tim, you're in control of that. Just remember. And you're in control over how much of the rent you actually pay. So you could say, hey, I had a lot of trouble, landlord, getting this thing ready. I only want to pay half the rent. Okay. You're going to have to decide whether that's reasonable for yourself.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let hosts Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. Two in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
All right, I'm selling my personal residence and move into my long-term rental that was originally a primary residence. How long do I need to live in it for the rental to be able to not have capital gains? Jeff? So it's a duplex. That's interesting. You're going to live in both sides, then you'd need to live in it 2 years. You're going to have a portion of it, depending on what the total amount of capital gains is. There's going to be a portion of it that you may not get to use the 121 exclusion on. That's going to be considered non-qualified use. Does it make sense to do a cost segregation if you plan to turn it into a personal residence down the road? Absolutely. That's the best case. Take the deduction now, never recapture it.
Right.
All you have to do, Mina, is live in it, and this is going to sound really crass, live in it until you die, and then the basis steps up, and they can redepreciate it. It's literally that's the case. You could write off a house over and over and over again if you're smart enough to never let it get sold. All right. How do I separate the cost of a washer, dryer, refrigerator, kitchen cabinets, AC system, wooden floors, et cetera, from a recently purchased condo? The contract shows the total price only. This is where you do cost segregation. And this is where you have somebody come in. Because otherwise, this is, I think, even the appliances, do they get lumped in too?
I think they're five-year properties. So.
Yeah, we got to break them out. And so this is a great example of, you know, cost segregation's been around forever, guys. It's just this year they did this bonus depreciation on used property. And I shouldn't say this year. It was anything after September 27th, 2017, I think is what it was. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it used to be you had to buy it brand new and put it into service. And then that bonus depreciation just says, hey, rather than write it off in 5 years, why don't you just write it off in 1 year if you want to? It's bonus, 100%. So that washer, dryer, refrigerator, and the AC system for sure would be right off right away. The wooden floors would have a usable life. I want to say 5 year. The cabinets, I'm not sure. What do they do cabinets at?
They also, those are probably 7 year.
7 year?
Mm-hmm.
So all of it, anything less than 20 years, you could write off in year one.
And while you could theoretically separate the cost yourself, under audit, you're going to have to be able to support how you divided those costs up. Whereas if you get a cost segregation, they're going to do it for you. They do it fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. And that is your support for how you divided it up.
Yeah, you're going to win. If there's ever an audit, you're going to win it. But they're not even going to audit it. They just don't see it. If they do, they're going to ask you whether you have a report. You send them the report, it's done.
Right.
We have a lawyer that has pretty bit of experience in those. And he's like, get the report. It's over. Goodbye. Done. Let's see. Somebody says, I have a Schedule E rental income. I'm thinking of issuing myself a 1099 to fund a 401k. Yeah, you can't do that. If you have a Schedule E rental income, you're going to have to run it through a corporation or something. And if you did, then would it trigger Medicare and Social Security tax? If you pay yourself, a 1099 just means you're a sole proprietor. I don't know if you can pay yourself as a sole proprietor from your own property on a Schedule E. You do that?
No, I don't think you can.
I don't think you can either. But
I'm not even sure why you would want to.
Well, here's what you might. Let's say you're a high-income person and you have a bunch of rental properties. You set up a management corporation, then it pays you and defer it all into a 401k. That's where it might make sense. And just say, hey, I'll pay a little bit of employment taxes, but I don't have to pay all them massive income taxes. So here's the trick. You run the numbers and you just determine. If I rent a home and do not take the depreciation, the tax return, by the time I sell, will I have to recapture? Maria, you'll have to recapture. The rule with depreciation is you may take depreciation, but you must recapture it. So whether you take it or not, you're going to have to.
Yeah. And it's less about the recapture as depreciation lowers your cost basis every year. And even if you're not taking depreciation, your cost basis is going down by however much depreciation you should have taken.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bought a property for $200,000 and sell it down the road and maybe has $100,000 worth of depreciation on it or should have,
mm-hmm.
your cost basis is only going to be $100,000. So your gain is going to be a lot larger than what you would have expected it to be.
Okay, here's another fun one. Converted a personal residence into a long-term rental. I deeded the property into an LLC and have property insurance in the name of the LLC. So who owns that property? The LLC owns. However, I was told that an LLC is worthless since in the event a claim came against the property, a smart lawyer could just argue that the LLC doesn't own the property since my personal name is on the loan. Is that true? No, absolutely not. A smart lawyer could argue whatever they want. At the end of the day, they look at title. Who owns it? You may have a loan, and that's certainly an indication that you owned the property. And a mortgage company may object to you putting in the LLC saying, hey, you have to pay me off. I never seen one. One time in 22 years, I've seen somebody object to that. That was a mortgage company. Mm-hmm. Usually they don't care. If you do, you just use a trust in between them. So what people always do is they throw these things out there like, oh, a smart lawyer's going to do that. Yeah, the lawyer's going to throw all sorts of crud at the wall. Doesn't mean anything because it's just going to be, they're going to say, who's the landowner? And it's going to be, you deeded it into the LLC. So the LLC is now the party if it's being a property claim. You have insurance, the insurance is going to cover. They're going to give you somebody to defend, and that keeps you out of the firing line. Even with a personal obligation. And then, yes, you do an umbrella as well. So somebody says an umbrella versus an LLC, you do both. The really what an umbrella policy is to make sure you don't pay for the lawyers. I don't know if you've ever defended yourself in a lawsuit. I've defended myself in plenty because I have a lot of properties and I own a business with, we have 250 employees. It's just a cost of doing business and anything. You're going to find yourself where, you know, I've had tree falls on properties. I've had people try to go after the mold nonsense and all that fun stuff. At the end of the day, I just look at it as a transaction. The money, the insurance is there is to help you with the lawyers. At the end of the day, you're just trying to get back to make sure it's income producing. But don't buy into that nonsense about mortgages or something being indicative of liability. It doesn't. I could actually co-sign on your property. It doesn't make me liable for the actions that occur on that property. Legal ownership is legal ownership. Will the bonus for qualified improvement property come back? Is that on?
There is a bonus for qualified improvement property now. What they did away with was the bonus for qualified leasehold improvements and qualified restaurant improvements, qualified.
That's what I thought you were talking about. But they do the bonus depreciation. So
yes, so there is.
But you don't get it on a leasehold, do you?
No. So the new bonus is slimmed down quite a bit from what it used to be. It's very particular. Off the top of my head, I can't remember all the constraints on it, but there still is that qualified improvement.
Mm-hmm. Let's see what else we have. So that's a good answer. Do you think it's going to come back? Maybe. Probably after they get rid of the bonus depreciation. I have a single family residence and I'm under contract to sell. It's been a full-time rental, not my primary residence. Is it possible to 1031 into a REIT or triple net lease or something other than residential property? Yes. So your property can go to any property. You can actually go into a TIC, too, a tenant in common. You can go into a Delaware statutory trust. You could go into a REIT, some REITs qualify.
Yeah,
some do. It's going to have to be a private REIT, right?
But they do find real estate for 1031s is very wide. It's a very wide definition.
Oh yeah. So again, I would have somebody on a 1031 exchange. I have a really good gal out in Idaho. Real fair, real good price. So if you want to shoot me over, I'll share you with your information. If I aggregate my rentals to take advantage of real estate professional, will suspended losses still be taken for passive income? Great question.
No, unfortunately, when you become a real estate professional, and it's actually a year-by-year election, only the current year income becomes non-passive. Any passive losses on a property remain passive until you have passive income to offset it.
Mm-hmm. So it just sits there and then you have, so could you say, hey, no, I'm not going to be a real estate professional, take those losses and offset some gain in that particular year. Could you do that type of planning?
Yeah, I think you could. I think that would be an excellent idea that I'm not going to aggregate for this year. I'm not going to claim real estate professional this year because maybe I'm selling a property and I want to release some of those.
Yeah. All right, we're going to get back to these questions. And Rick, on the 1099 issue, yeah, you don't pay yourself a management fee from your own. To yourself, we'd have to set up a corporation to be the manager, and then you can. So you can get it. I'll go over a great example. You said, hey, I have a high tax burden. This is where you set up a C corporation and let the corporation pay the tax on it. Get it out to you tax-free over a period of time. But the corporation is taxed at 21%. It's usually a lot better just to have it go in there or just to get it out there, then get it back to yourself in a tax reduced manner, like a medical reimbursement plans, doing 280A renting, you know, reimbursing yourself for the use of your home, things like that, that only come from an accountable plan. You can't do those individually. So the corporation opens up a different world to us as far as being an employee. So that's a big one. So Rick, if you want to talk about that, shoot something over to Patty and she'll get you scheduled with somebody. They can run the numbers on you and see if it makes sense. End of the day, our services, the way I always look at it is we should be a negative number. So it's the old adage of value over price. So you can pay somebody $500 to do some tax planning and pay your $10,000 tax bill, or you could pay somebody $10,000 and save $50. End of the day, I'm going with the $10,000 to save $50, not the $500 to not save anything. So I'm not going to say that's what our numbers are always going to be. And frankly, I always kind of look at it and say our average is probably about an extra $20,000 of deductions. So it's going to be a pretty good value. It's basically what we want is we want to make sure that if you're doing tax planning, it should put money in your pocket. It should not be costing you. All right, here's a fun one. Parents own a home with two extra rooms for their two kids. So mom and dad, or dad and dad, I don't know how to say that, parents, and you have two kids, and the kids get together and say, hey, why don't we share a room and rent out the spare room, which is just kind of weird. I'm trying to think of who they rent it to, the guy down the street.
Creepy guy.
Yeah. So this is funny. So the idea is, all right, the kids don't own the house, first off. Number two, the kids, if they're under 23 and you're providing them with assistance, that's called kiddie tax. It's going to be aggregated and put on the parents' tax bracket anyway. Another weird one is if you're renting out the room, what are you going to depreciate the room? Like, hey, I have a three-room house. I'm going to take depreciation on a third to offset the income. I suppose you could.
Yeah. I mean, but what it comes down to is the parents own the home. They would be the ones renting out that spare room.
Mm-hmm.
And supposing it's going to be rented out for more than 14 days, it's all going to be rental income.
If it's rental income and you did, let's just say you said, hey, I'm giving it to my kids for nothing and my kids are making a profit on it.
Sandwich lease?
Yeah. It's still passive income that for kiddie tax purposes gets added back into the parents' income.
Yeah.
Like there's no way for the kids to get this. Although I love this question. In fact, I'll probably borrow this and see if anybody was paying attention tomorrow morning when I meet with all the attorneys and accountants. And I like to throw weird questions at them. This is fun because this literally is, let's just say that your kids rented the house from you. I don't know. Could you do that? And you gift it to them. You gift them the use of the room and then they rent it out.
Well, would the kids even be entitled to, could they make a real estate transaction, do a real estate lease?
No, if they're under 18, they couldn't even, they lack the capacity.
That's what I
but let's say that you put it in their names, then the kiddie tax is bringing it back to the parents.
Just,
no matter
just the room?
Just the room. I'm just trying to think of who they're going to rent it to. Like I'm actually thinking of like horrible examples, but I was thinking like Kramer from Seinfeld. Like I would rent it to Kramer just so I could like be annoyed. Like, what would he do? Hide in his room? And then when you knocked on the door, he like, bah! Wasn't a great Seinfeld guy, but there's some good moments there. Does the kid's income get taxed at the trust rates? No, it goes to the, John, it goes to the parents. It actually gets added back into the parents. It's called the kiddie tax. Anytime you have passive income going to the kids, it's going to get added back in the parents' bracket if they're under 18 for sure. And if the parents are supporting them and they're under 23, I think it is. We have an LP for our stock investments. It is 1% owned by the C Corp. With a new tax law, can we still deduct investing class and investing newsletter expenses within the LP? No, the LP would pay the corporation. The corporation would receive that as a guaranteed payment to partner, and it would pay for those expenses, bringing your taxable income to nothing. That's actually, Tim, the way you're structured is the only way to do it now under the new tax laws, and you're doing it perfect. You know, sometimes what I do is I make the corporation a little bit more owner, maybe 10%, 20%, so I don't have to pay it a guaranteed payment. I did just the percentage of the profit goes in there, but the way you're doing it is perfect. So you get a star. Somebody asked a really interesting question before we go on to more. Let's see. Can an individual foreigner national take advantage of the 1031 exchange when he is selling the property, which is in the LLC name and otherwise fully qualified for 1031 exchange? So here's the question, really. Can an LLC owned by a non-US citizen do a 1031 exchange? And I know that 1031 exchange pushes it out in its U.S. income. I don't believe there's a restriction on foreigners.
I can't think of a restriction in that Mm-mm. aspect.
Yeah, I'm not 100% certain. Don't quote me, but I believe you're going to be fine, at least on the U.S. sourced income. So just remember that you're going to have to worry about the treaty in your country too. If you are not a resident alien, like if you're a resident alien, then I can say definitively it's going to be, you can do it in your only taxes here. U.S. is one of two countries that actually taxes worldwide revenue. Most countries just say, no, you get a, you know, but again, you want to look at your treaty. So depending on where you're a citizen of, would control. I'm doing flips currently on an LLC. I was thinking to set up a C Corp for flips and another LLC taxes an S Corp for the management properties, which is fine. That actually works. I'm confused with the following. C Corp pays 21%. But if I want to take the profits out, I'll be taxed again. Not necessarily. So C Corporation pays 21% on net profit. But if you pay it out to yourself as a salary or as a reimbursement, then it's not taxed again. If it is taxed again, it's taxed, assuming that it's U.S. taxation and it's a U.S. company paying out a qualified dividend, then it's taxed at your long-term capital gains rate, which could be 0, 15, or 20%. It sounds like if you really want the money, you get more money into the S Corp because then it just flows onto your tax return. So I hope that makes sense. Let's go back to some of these questions. Great question on the parents, by the way. That's the type of stuff that I really enjoy. Oh, book. I did this, I think, last week because we had a 100th episode. So this is our 101st. But we're going to do a pre-order on the TaxWise book, assuming I get off my duff and finish it up in the next couple weeks. We'll get this thing out in the next, hopefully in October, early November, and you'll get a copy. It's $10. You can pre-order if you like. It's a fourth edition. If you like this sort of stuff, it's a good handbook to have. Jumping back in, for an equity investor, what is the best way to structure ownership when concerning taxes? An LLC, personal, can the LLC be from the home state of the investment property? All right, equity investor, what does that say to you, Jeff?
I'm thinking that they're just putting money in. They're not the actual owner of the property. I might be getting this totally wrong.
Mm-hmm. I just say when I see an equity investor, I'm thinking equities.
Ah.
And so I'm always thinking like, so the first time I read this, I was like, oh, it's somebody doing stocks and equities. Like, all right, but
But they do say at the end, the home state of the investment property.
Yeah, so maybe they're an equity investor, meaning that they're dumping money into a syndication.
Okay.
And here's what I would say. If it's an LLC that you're investing in, then we have two types of liability. We have inside liability that comes and gets you if you have a piece of property in your name and they sue you. Or sue the property. You don't want it to come over to you personally. So like if let's say that I'm a doctor and I make $1 million a year and I'm a great surgeon and I buy a $50,000 house in Indianapolis and I say, what's the worst thing that could happen? And somebody says, oh, you know, they're just if something bad happens on that property, they're just going to take the property. No, they're not. They're going to garnish you forever because you make $1 million a year. So you put a box around it. That's called an LLC. And that way they can't get out of the box. They're stuck in the box. And then there's outside liability. So let's say that same doctor has that property in an LLC and he commits egregious malpractice and gets sued for $30 million. Then they take the LLC away. That's outside liability, somebody taking the LLC away. Another way to look at it is if you had a safe, there's stuff inside the safe. Because let's say you put something in there that's explosive and it blows up inside the safe. It destroys everything inside the safe. That's inside liability. Outside liability is if somebody takes your safe. So kind of fun.
It is.
All right. So what are we talking about?
Kind of get a bigger safe.
Yeah. Can the LLC? So realistically, what I would say is if you have an LLC that you're investing in, you're fine. If you're worried, if you have personal liabilities, I'd probably put that in an LLC. And I'd move that LLC out in the desert where nobody can find your safe. So I would put it in Wyoming where nobody can get it, or Nevada where nobody can get it. And the reason you do that, and people always say, oh, that's kind of sticky. I've litigated some pretty major cases. And I personally obtained judgments right at $100 million. So I know about what I'm talking about, guys. Lots of people give out advice that don't actually do this stuff. And usually it's because they haven't been up close and personal with it. So, you know, I'm just going to basically leave it at that. You want to make sure that your stuff is not easy to find and very difficult to take. Otherwise, someone's just going to find it and take it. You know, somebody says, can a family living trust be made the managing member of an LLC? Is it legal and a recommended business practice? Does the structure provide a reasonable level of asset protection? So realistically, no, you wouldn't make it a managing member. I use managing members seldom, and it's only when it's an LLC or corporation owning another LLC or corporation. So Kevin, what I would do is, you know, if you have to have somebody listed as a managing individual, you make it a managing, it's manager managed. So make the LLC, the member be the living trust, and then make you be the manager. Or technically, I love to see managers be corporations. And that's just because I like to keep the inside liability away from you. And in order to keep it away from you, I have to put it inside a box. And the only types of boxes we have are corporations and LLCs, LPs. You know, trusts really aren't a asset protection tool. They're good for keeping your name out of the record. And also, the living trust is magic when it comes to estate planning because it doesn't go through probate, keeps you out of court. So anyway, here's another good one. Jeff, you'll like this. My brother owns a home. I rent a room in the home. I operate my small business from my room. Can I write off a percentage of this space as my home office? That is wild. Yeah. Has to be exclusive use.
Has to be exclusive use.
So, Chris, what you do is you make an area that is your home office, and you make sure that it looks like a home. You're never going to get questioned because if you do this right, use a corporation, it reimburses you. But, yes, it can actually reimburse you.
I've just run into some that's everything but my bed was business use.
I actually had one. This isn't me. It was from another accountant, and they put files all over the beds, and they took pictures of it. So they said, we don't use it as a bed. We use it as a file cabinet. I was like, that's a big file cabinet.
That is.
Mm-hmm. That is weird, though. But it works. You know, the IRS just enforces the rule. What's best, S-Corp or C-Corp? Ronnie, what kind of question is that? It depends on what we're doing. I'm gonna hassle Ronnie. It really depends. If you need the money, you use an S-Corp. If you don't need the money, you use a C-Corp. If you have lots of medical expenses that you're not getting any reimbursement for and you have no employees, you use a C-Corp. And sometimes you use them both. It's like big old depends. Parents, you know, wanted me to be a lawyer so I could learn to say that and get paid for it. Right there with the accountants, yeah. It depends. In case, here, I'm going to go through this one and then somebody asked me a good question on these LLCs. If I sell my personal residence, so they sell their personal residence, they have $140,000 in equity. What would be the best strategy to use the funds from the sale for my RAL setup? That's a residential assisted living. So that's helping folks out that need activities of daily living assistance. And that could be adult autistic, that could be elders, that could be clean and sober living. There's a whole bunch that fall underneath that. I do have a QRP, which is also known as 401k. So qualified retirement plan. So can I use those retirement funds for the upgrades and repay the loan from the proceeds? So this is, I'm going to break this into two pieces. So number one, you have a personal residence. You have $140,000 in equity. That doesn't tell me what the gain is. So I need to know what you bought it for, what improvements you put in. But let's just say that when they say equity, they actually mean appreciation. And that's their gain. And they never used it for a rental. Then you would get, assuming that you are married, you would get all of it tax-free. And assuming that you are single, you would get $125,000 of it tax-free, which if you sold it, you're going to have some deductions for all the expense. So it's probably going to be right around $125,000 anyway. So first off, you get that money and it's tax-free. If it is not tax-free, then there's some other strategies we do to try to mitigate those taxes. You could do qualified opportunity zones. You could do giving money to charity. You could have other losses, whatever, to try to offset it. So you may sell some loser properties. Actually, would that offset the gain out of a personal residence?
Yeah, if there was taxable gain, it would.
So basically, you're going to get that, whatever that cash is when it's all said and done, you're going to have that tax-free. Now, could you use that in your startup? Heck yeah, and it's not going to hurt you. And would it still be deductible by the startup? Of course. It's just whether it's going to be deductible in year one or whether it's going to be amortized. It all comes down to whether it's a current expense or whether it's a startup expense. I do have a QRP, so I could use those retirement funds for the upgrades and repay the loan from the proceeds. Yes, with a QRP, you can borrow up to $50,000. Excuse me, somebody just said, isn't 250 single? Yes, you're right, Michael. You should have slapped me, Jeff. I'm just rattling off nonsense. Yeah, the personal residence, it's 250, 500. Excuse me, I'm thinking 125. It is. It's $250,000. So there's not going to be any tax on the equity no matter what.
Right.
Catch, Michael. We're just checking with you guys.
See, I was thinking that they didn't live there for 2 years, so they didn't.
There might be a portion. So they lived in it one out of the
last 5 years.
They only got half. That's horrible. All right. No, I was just brain fart.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
All right, I do have a QRP. Now, so with the QRP, you can borrow up to $50,000, up to half the funds, and then you have to pay it back in 5 years. So you could absolutely use your QRP. You could absolutely borrow those funds out of the QRP and then repay it. And you pay it at federal AFR rates, which is right around, 3%? Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to throw on that one? I just threw a bunch out there. I thought that was pretty good. All right. Somebody's asked a couple of questions. So let's see. In the case of Wyoming holding trust, which holds multiple state LLCs, will Living Trust own the Wyoming LLC or the hierarchy of holding be different? So Sam, you're absolutely right. So when you own something and you own it personally, you could be looking at probate. If you own it through your Living Trust, then you don't. So if you have a Wyoming entity that owns a whole bunch of LLCs in different states that own real estate, which is typical structure, we have inside liability in all the LLCs that own the real estate, and then we have outside liability because we have the Wyoming Holding Trust. It's perfect. Yes, you own that as a trustee of your living trust. You don't have to worry about probating that thing. Is there a way to avoid the California franchise tax if you have a living trust which owns the Wyoming Holding LLC? And Sam, the answer is, yeah, we won that audit at five or 6 years ago. Where the individual wasn't the owner, the trust was the owner. If you ask the franchise tax board, they're always going to tell you have to pay it. But we've been checked on that one, and we prevailed, or I should say the client prevailed. That said, if that holding entity files a 1065, they're going to come after you for it. So I always say just pay one and don't mess around with it. They're always going to say pay me more if you ever ask them. That's just because they need the money. If I conduct meetings with current and potential business partners in my office at home, can I get reimbursed by my C-Corp for landscaping costs? One, so if you're talking about business use of your home and you have a home office and you meet people there, then yes, you can actually add the cost of landscaping into your reimbursement from your corporation to you for allowing them to use your home. If you're doing a home office, I think you could write it off too. If you're doing the standard 8869 on a Schedule C, mm-hmm. at the form, then you can write it off too, right? So, so if you're meeting people there, it better be consistent. Like if it's just one-time deal, probably not. If you're constantly meeting clients there and business partners, then yes. Pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered, so don't be too crazy. If you trade stocks or options, small account, $30,000 in a C-Corp, do you need an LLC managed by the C-Corp? Jane, no. I put that inside the corporation. Just know that all the profits are in the corp. I get reimbursed by my S-Corp. Can I get reimbursed by my S-Corp for the use of my personal pickup truck for the last three quarters of the year? The truck is financed in my name, so you own it individually, and you're making the payments, but you're using the truck for business. Jeff, what say you?
Well, you can definitely get reimbursed for the business use of your truck. I would strongly recommend tracking mileage. You're going to have track mileage regardless.
Use Mile IQ. It's a little app you get on your phone, and Mile IQ will track GPS. It'll track your miles, and then you swipe left for business, right for personal type thing. I think it's left and right. I can't remember which one. If the mileage was ugly, you swipe left. Don't start with me, Jeff. All right, so I get reimbursed. Yeah, you get reimbursed, and it doesn't matter. Just make sure you're tracking your miles. Now, if the truck was financed in your name and you're making the payments, then you may just have a standard personal policy. You better make sure that it covers you when you're driving it around for business. And somebody says, can you get reimbursed for gas? No. So you have to choose. You can only choose once. I tend to choose to do the mileage reimbursement. The other route is the actual cost method, where you write off the actual cost of the gas or the repairs mm-hmm. that are associated with the business. And usually what you do is you say, all right, how many miles did you run for business? How many gallons of gas did you use? If you do an oil change, you figure out what percentage is used. You can see how this can be a big pain. If you have to get improvements or like if you get your truck fixed, you get a bunch of work done on it, it's $1,000. Then you get to figure out what percentage was business. It was 20%, so I can reimburse myself $200 versus just doing the, 58 cents a mile. Versus 58 cents a mile. Those are your two choices. And I'm always going to tell you, like 99% of the time, it's just do the mileage.
Yeah, the mileage deduction actually includes all those different types of actual expenses. But like if you're making payments on the vehicle, you cannot be reimbursed for that. The interest portion, yes. The principal portion, no.
Right. And somebody just asked, if the truck is owned by the business, can you still do mileage or do you have to do actual expenses? You do the actual expenses and you're allocated a portion of the lease value of that to you personally for your personal use. So you actually look at how much is the truck worth and then you allocate as though you got paid wages, whatever percentage of that dollar amount. And it could be a lot.
Right.
If the car's worth $30,000 or $40,000, you're probably going to be allocated $7,000 to $8,000 a year. If
it's it gets included on your W-2, you pay taxes on it.
And self-employment tax and everything, right?
I think it's exempt from self-employment. I think it's federal.
All right, so that's good. Federal and state. Right? So you treat it like they paid you money. It's like if I gave Jeff a Lamborghini tomorrow and said, great job, Jeff, and I gave him a Lamborghini, he has to pay tax. I have to do withholdings on the value of the Lambo. I'm not going to give you a Lamborghini, though. I know. You're too sick. Cough up a lung and crash. All right. I traveled via he's a trooper. The truck is used
to see too because she said, oh my gosh, Jeff was in a wreck. I hope the Lamborghini is not too
The truck is used exclusively for business, in which case then you would just write off all the expenses, Karen.
Yep.
Somebody just says, can along the lines of the Wyoming LLC being held by the living trust, can a single member LLC but not a parent company be owned by the living trust? Yes, absolutely. That does make sense, Kevin. And yeah, we try to keep you out of probate. People don't understand how probate is. Here's my little simple rule. I've been watching this stuff for years and I've had friends go through this. I've been through this for family members. Bad things happen in probate. And this is the way I put it. It's more likely than not that bad stuff's going to happen if you have to go to court on probate. People are going to hate each other. They don't like doing paperwork. They're all ticked off. They're digging through stuff. It's not good. It's more likely than not it's going to be bad. On the flip side, not going through probate and actually having some sort of estate plan done, it's more likely than not that it's going to turn out good. In fact, it's going to be a positive, and they're going to realize that somebody cared about them. And there's usually a trust, and it usually has really cool things in it. If we're drafting it, I like to put goofy stuff in there like, hey, if you're going to be a beneficiary, you should have to travel outside the country. We love to sponsor you to go outside the country every year, pick a different country every year. Just something goofy like that. And people are like, well, I have to leave the country every year. Well, guess what? That's good. That's a good thing, as opposed to I just got a bunch of money dumped on me and I have to go to court to fight it out with my siblings. Anyway, so I get crunchy on that. I traveled across the via RV cross country, and even out of the country. So let's say they went up to Banff, Canada, right? Mm-hmm. You're driving around your RV and needed Wi-Fi to conduct business. Can any part of the travel expense be deducted? So here's the rule. If you are traveling for leisure and it's more than 50% leisure, you're not writing off any business expenses associated with that trip. If you are using that RV to do a business trip while on a personal trip, so in other words, I'm driving around personally, but I have to take a business trip from my personal location and I'm driving around, then I would reimburse myself mileage and pay for my Wi-Fi and other things that are actual expenses of the business. In other words, just because you are on vacation does not negate your ability to take business expenses.
But what you might be able to deduct is the cost of the Wi-Fi.
You can write off the Wi-Fi, which would be good. And especially if you have to add it to your RV, like, hey, I have to make sure that I can work while I'm traveling, then that's a business expense.
Absolutely.
So the RV stuff, people sometimes try to write off the RV. Again, it qualifies as travel and get miles. Can I rent my RV to my corporation for meetings? How is it taxed? Well, this gets fun because the rule, there's something called 280A G2, 26 USC, if you like to have the full site. And what it says is you can write off, or I shouldn't say you can write off, the company can write off lease payments. You don't have to recognize those lease payments as income if it's 14 days or less. And it just has to be a dwelling. And a dwelling, an RV qualifies so long as it has a sleeping quarters and a bathroom.
Yep.
So if you could dwell in it, then your corporation can rent it. And so the corporation would literally write you whatever the fair market value of an RV is for a day so it could have a meeting. And it's not taxed. If it's 14 days or left, it's tax-free and the company writes it off. Somebody says, please explain the 50% business personal versus business requirements to deduct trip expenses. All right. So I finish up that. Do you have anything you want to add on the RV?
No, go ahead.
So the corporation pays you for the use of the RV. If it's 14 days or less, you don't have to recognize it as income. You don't report anywhere. The corporation writes it off as
expense. Well, and the same applies for a boat.
A
bathroom, yep. And a berth to sleep in.
Or any dwelling. It doesn't have to be your personal residence. Most people use it personal residence, right. But it could actually be your vacation rental, your timeshare, and all that stuff. All right, 50% personal versus business. All right, so Tim, when you travel outside of your home area and you're going someplace, you're going to spend the night. If it's more than 50% business, you can write the whole travel expense going there off. And then you can also deduct the cost of remaining alive while you're on that trip. So the way it works is this. Let's say that I'm traveling somewhere, and while I'm in that city, I'm going to go to a football game. So let's say I go to Seattle and I go on a Friday. And I know I'm going to do business and I have more business on Monday. Now I have to look and say, all right, is it more than 50% business? So I think the way we count that is business days. And a business day is 4 hours and 1 minute.
Right.
Plus the time to travel up there. Plus weekends or holidays that occur between business days. So let's go over my example. I flew up on Friday to meet on Friday. I stayed for a Seahawks game on Sunday, and I went to a meeting on Monday. So I have Friday, assume that I did 4 hours and 1 minute, and Monday, 4 hours and 1 minute of business.
Mm-hmm.
If I did that scenario, I get the days before them to travel. So I get Thursday, Friday, and then I get Monday and Tuesday, travel day after, and I get the weekend days. So now I have a total of, six business days.
Right.
That means that if I wanted to keep that trip being business and write off the entire cost of the airfare going up to Seattle, I have an extra 5 days I could stay up there. Now, the hotels and things, I'd be able to write off Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. And if I stay another 5 days, that's going to come out of me. That's not going to be deductible unless I wrap it into more.
Yeah, this is one of those weird rules that when you say 50% of your time, you're counting by hours per each day. So I do.
Yeah.
Four hours here, 4 hours here, 4 hours here. So I have 12 business hours, or just say 12 and a half business hours out of 6 days. Mm-hmm. I've done qualified, even though that's not half the time that I've actually spent in travel.
You just have to say it's a business day. Yeah. And
So it really works out to your advantage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Gosh, we have a bunch of questions that just popped in. I'm going to go to the ones about the RVs. So we have two about RVs. Can we do the 280A deduction 14 days for both my home and my RV if the RV is on the same property as my home? That's pretty funny. So, Blakely, here's the deal. The statute doesn't say that the taxpayer is limited to 14, but it's inferred. And there's a court case that says it's 14 days for the taxpayer. So I would say 14 days total. But you could get crazy because the statute doesn't put that limitation. It just says that a taxpayer may rent his or her residence for less than 15 days a year and not include that in their taxable income as adjusted gross income. I think it's Section 61. So the answer to your question is, yeah, technically you might be able to try to make that argument. I wouldn't do it because I think you lose it. Besides, pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered. And then you say, I actually do use both for office purposes and meetings. I get it. You might be able to do the home office reimbursement. That's separate than the 280A. And that's also tax-free. And that assumes that you use it exclusively for business. That's a portion of it that's used exclusively for business. So you better have a section on your RV that's only business. Let's see, what can you do if a co-trustee did work on a trust property using her own company, build the trust over $3,000, and I, as co-trustee, did not approve it? Well, Robert, that sounds like you have an issue. I'd have to see the trust agreement. Trust agreements usually say both trustees have to unanimously agree on things, or either one can act. And then if you'd have to show that they violated their duty to the beneficiaries. And it looks like a little self-dealing, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're toast. So I'd have a little chat with that. Somebody says, do we have to actually make a payment record of this expense or just paperwork? Just document it. So if the corporation has a shareholder meeting outside the country, is that expense deductible? Yes. It all depends on what the major reasoning of the going outside the country for comes down to. All right, let's go back to this. We've got a couple more questions. I sold one of my rental homes this year. If I have a gain of $200,000, and invest in a syndication buying an apartment complex. And if they use bonus depreciation, will it offset any part of my gain? Jeff, what say you?
Well, it will offset your gain, but not directly. It'll be just an expense that will be on return. I mean, I'm not sure I'm explaining this right.
Right. So you have a rental house, you made $200,000, and you have a syndication that loses $200,000 because you took bonus depreciation. You're going to offset your gain. In other words, whatever the loss is off the syndication is going to offset your gain on the sale of the rental house.
I think sometimes we get confusion that people are looking for things to actually offset a certain type of income, whereas we're offsetting total income, not a particular type of income.
Well, this is a capital gains on a rental house, and assume that it's gain plus depreciation recapture, right? And then they have a bunch of bonus depreciation. Will it offset it?
Yes, and in this case, you don't want the gain or the bonus depreciation offsetting the capital gain. You just want to lower your income because your capital gain is going to be at a much lower tax rate.
Yep. Yeah, it's always comes down to it is what are you offsetting?
Right.
Maybe I don't want to take it. Do you have to take it or can you roll losses forward?
Well, you can roll business losses forward. But in this case, I'm assuming you're going to have other income on top of things. So it's going to work out.
The answer is it can offset it. Is it a good idea to do cost segregation for a rental property that's been rented for 20 years? You're not going to get much out of it, Jorge, but I showed an example during that webinar I did. If you need that link, we could send it out to you guys. But I did a precise example kind of like this where somebody did a cost seg right before they sold. And it was only about $800,000 of a sale, but I think it saved them about $70,000. And again, it's the idea that when you do a cost segregation and you break off the pieces of your building into smaller chunks, you're going to get capital gains as opposed to depreciation recapture on bigger portions of it. Because again, the way that the world works, the way that the IRS works is your carpet has just as much value as the rest of that structure. So after 20 years, there's a bunch of stuff in that building, Jorge, that's not worth anything. Nobody's going to pay for it. But the way the IRS treats it is you have to recapture that at 25% or whatever your ordinary tax bracket is if it's less. So I hope that helps. So the answer to your question is always ask for a study. It doesn't cost you anything. May as well. And if it looks good, like I just had this yesterday, somebody was selling a house and they're like, oh, they did a segregation study and it was going to double the money it cost it was not a huge amount of money. I think it would save them $7,000 and was going to cost them $3,000. And they're like, oh, that's not much. And I said, yeah, it's not much, but double your money. It's free money. It's on the sale. It's not like you have to recapture any portion of that. This is just raw money. If I got for every dollar I gave somebody, they gave me $2. I just keep giving them dollars. So it's one of those things. Usually you want big chunks. Usually we're trying to get big chunks. But if you're selling it, just check it out. If you're not selling it, then don't. Two for Tuesday. So I forget what we're doing here. Oh, here we go. TaxWise Workshop. I have one coming up. Keep forgetting what time of the year it is. We're in October now. So you get access to all the recordings. We're doing one more, I think, in November of the TaxWise. Yeah. And that's going to be the end of year special. So we're just going to be really focusing on grabbing your 199A deductions, making sure it does apply to rental properties under certain circumstances, how to make sure that gets done. We're going to talk about setting up retirement plans for the end of the year. We're going to talk about doing some, making sure things are in place that have to be put in before the end of the year and money transfers during the year. And then we also have the bulletproof real estate investing, make your investments bulletproof. We're going to do these as a twofer. And the making your bullets, your investments bulletproof is that you're going to get tickets to a 3-day class. It's two tax and asset protection workshop tickets. That's a 3-day class, guys. You come out to Vegas or wherever we hold them. We're having them in Boston. We just had one in Chicago. We have them in California. We have them in Texas all the time, Florida. You come on out, spend 3 days with us. You won't be sorry. You're going to get the tax and asset protection book that Clint wrote called Tax and Asset Protection for Real Estate Investors. And we're going to give you a 3-part video series from Clint, Michael, and myself, along with a wealth planning blueprint. We're going to give that all to you, including the TaxWise workshop, for $197. So if you want to take advantage of that, absolutely do. I'd love to have you. There's got to be a link somewhere. I don't see a link, but just email us in at Tax Tuesday and request. Here's free stuff. The podcast, which I just did a podcast today with a guy named Dave Rafus, who does service dogs for veterans that are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Guy's pretty amazing. He ended up getting service dogs down to $2,500 for training with all the people that are working on it. It's pretty amazing. And it literally takes the suicide rate pretty darn down to zero, pretty close to zero for these veterans, because now they have something to really live for. And it's a huge issue, guys. I don't talk about that stuff on the Tax Tuesdays because, frankly, it's a tax class. But let's just be human beings for a second. We have a lot of folks that come back from overseas and they're traumatized. And it's not just our veterans. It's also first responders. They see some pretty heinous stuff. And it's really tough to deal with. And we can pretend like it's not an issue, but more people die over here by their own hands than die overseas at the hands of our enemies. And it's about time that we figured it out. So I did this really cool podcast with them, and it's on our podcast now. Go to iTunes and it's free. Anderson Business Advisor Podcast. And then we also have it on Google. It's also free. And it's pretty darn amazing, guys. Again, I just cannot believe to do a service dog was like $50,000 in this guy and his group have got it down to $2,500. It's a big deal. If you want to sponsor, just go out and sponsor somebody. I always say it starts local. You don't have to tell anybody. If you want to keep it a secret, just go sponsor somebody, go help somebody. If you like working with the veterans, then that's a guy I can tell you. He's pretty down to earth. He was a former Marine. And he's just like, seems like a salt of the earth. I've met him personally. And I've just, you know, again, you see people and you see the way they interact with folks. And this is a good dude. And then, you know, again, if you like this sort of information, pop on. We're education junkies around here. We like to teach. We like to share information. We try not to be pretentious about it as much as Jeff likes to make fun of me constantly. Mm-hmm. Gosh, Jeff, you got to just leave me alone. I'm just kidding. Jeff is awesome. We're all, you know, Jeff's CPA. I'm an attorney. We just sit here around and we try to come up with things that help people. Then you can always send in questions. We don't charge by the question. So Tax Tuesday at AndersonAdvisors.com. I know there's about 10 of them that I did not get to. We're going to keep popping them off. And so we go in order. So if you've sent in questions in the last week, chances are we didn't get to it. You'll still get an answer, but I didn't make it part of the show. Yeah, somebody says, I missed you in Chicago. You got to deal with my brother, Michael Bowman. I'm sure he's a fantastic speaker there in Chicago. And I think Carl was up there. Both great guys. Anyway, so there's your questions. Tax Tuesday, Anderson Advisors. And let's see, the tax sessions are anytime in the future, not a specific date. Actually, the tax-wise, if you hang on for a second, I'll tell you exactly when it is. I think it's November something. We have one coming up November 11th. So I think it's sold out physically, but you can still get on the live stream. Looks like it is sold out because it's in red. Let me just see if I can hide this thing. Yep, sold out. All right, so you can get on the live stream. The live event is all sold out. It's November 11th and 12th. It's always good to sell out of things, what, a month and a half ahead of time. Mm-hmm. But they're fun. They're popular. The reason they're popular is because people save a lot. I have a few really cool testimonials of people that saved over $100,000 just sitting there. And then it says, if we can't make November, what we do is we record them all. So you're going to get all three recordings anyway. So don't feel like if you can't make it personally, if you can't make it through the live stream, by all means, go ahead and grab it. It is approved for continuing education if you're if you are a professional. And it is, I go over the last time, I'll just tell you what I did. I went over 31 strategies, specific strategies for reducing tax. And when we do a strategy, we're just trying to do things that are going to put more money in your pocket. No offense to the Treasury, but I'd rather direct where my dollars go. I don't know if you guys feel the same way. And we'll go from there. So I just want to say how much I appreciate you guys. We went a little bit over, but not horribly. It's only 4:27 Pacific Standard Time. So 7:27 East Coast and all that fun. But I really appreciate you guys getting on. You guys are an awesome community. And we keep hearing really good stories coming out of you guys. So it's very exciting to see that people take this stuff serious, that you're spending some time with us. So again, my personal thanks. Jeff, do you have anything else?
No, except I'll try to be a little healthier next visit.
Yeah, Jeff gave up a lung for you guys. So Jeff's a trooper. He did really good. And I can hear Patty cackling in the background. So with that, I'll leave it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.